So what do you think of that?
Mind
blowing, really.
Yeah.
Oh, the most interesting discussion that's been had all day. I'm really glad we got it all on recording.
Well, I mean, I'm worried that with what I've just said there, I'm going to come off as maybe a bit too raw, a little bit too open, a little bit too honest.
I mean, maybe you might. I think the bigger worry is you might come off like too intelligent, like knowing too many things, and like that. You know, the veneer of this show being silly in the way that it should be might be broken by how groundbreaking that thought was.
Well, I think that really does highlight what I was talking about, that sort of dare I bite off on this biscuit, the duality of the situation that we're talking about. Yes, you're right. What I said was profound. It did speak to a generation. It spoke across generations. It spoke of the generations.
But was it dangerous?
Was it dangerous? Was it? I don't know.
I mean, it might be dangerous for us being able to keep this show going, because how are we even going to live up to that?
I mean,
now?
It's not for me to say. After the bombshell Conrad dropped last week, right at the closing moments, I mean, he knows all about danger. I mean, with that, I think you cemented your place as dare I say it, Pop's bad boy.
I made absolutely certain it's going to be very difficult for anybody to be put into a position of more risk than I have.
That is true.
But I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with it. I'm willing to take that on.
Yeah. Well, you've got your luck boxes. Like, I'm more worried about anything bad happening to you than you are, because I know about three of them are all for me. So it's in my best interest to keep you alive as long as possible.
That's correct.
That much I've learned because of the lockboxes. Unless I can find that disused railway station, I'm on the hook for life.
So welcome to Podquisition.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep in this entire conversation, and nothing will have been edited out at the start of this. It's a video game show. We're here ostensibly to talk about video games. Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking on my desk for things to show the audience, and then I remembered that this is an audio medium. So no point having
that hasn't stopped you in the past from picking up a thing from your desk and using it for the audio medium.
That's correct. In fact, I do it all the time.
Yeah, you just have to do a little description and then bam, visual is audio now.
I've got a Barbie eraser that the bloody kids got to. For some reason, we ended up with Barbie-themed crackers for Christmas. I say for some reason. Obviously, Barbie was a big thing last year because of the Barbie film, which is one of the best films ever made. And everyone had, like, really crap. There's some real crap in those fucking Christmas crackers. The only things...
I mean, that's just Christmas crackers in general, though.
True. They were so bad that an ordinary eraser, not even, like stencil cut shaped, just a plain square flat eraser that's pink with a printed picture of a Barbie doll, two Barbie dolls on the front, nothing on the other side. That was the hot ticket item. So that was my hot ticket item that I now see the corners have been chewed completely off of. So,
I mean, erasers in the presence of children, that's going to happen. That's just the natural state of things. You know, children are the natural predator of erasers.
It's the worst.
Who's played video games this week?
Oh, God.
Who's done some of them?
Christ.
Right.
I mean, I've played some. I've looked at some.
I mean, you guys have to talk about Final Fantasy, I think. I feel like that's obligated.
I've seen it around.
Yeah, you've been playing much of that Final Fantasy?
I have. Well, there's an interesting question.
Okay.
The question, have you been playing Final Fantasy VII? To which Final Fantasy VII does that pertain?
Have you been playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, the second part of the remake-ish trilogy?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when you say, have you been playing Final Fantasy Rebirth, the second part of the remake trilogy, I still have to ask, which one? Because are we talking about the actual part of the video game that's the video game? Or are we talking about the director's audition to be the director of the next WarioWare game? because there are many disparate games going on in here, and some of that was present in the first, but this one has lost its fucking mind.
WarioWare was not going to be my comparison point, but playing through this, I keep wanting to compare it to the fucking Like a Dragon RPG games with Ichiban.
Echo mentioned, because they're staying with us for a while, Echo,
yeah.
Echo has been walking in, watching me play it, and every time they walk in, something utterly stupid is happening on screen, and they burst out laughing.
Can I say the three words that broke me?
Yeah.
And they're a really stupid small thing.
Yeah.
Dog Rocket League.
Oh, don't get me started on Dog Rocket League.
Dog Rocket don't League is the one that broke me. Without getting into spoilers, some of those teams feel a little unbalanced in terms of potential strength.
It was actually shortly before that that got... Certainly, it broke Echo. It got Phoenix as well. And it's Cloud on the Segway, which I'm sure it's going to get and has got a lot of people. Cloud's serious little po-face riding around on a little fucking scooter.
It's funny you mention Cloud on the Segway, because this is why I keep wanting to compare this to fucking Like a Dragon. The most recent Like a Dragon, set in Hawaii, there's a very Hawaii-ish setting in this. You've got a Segway, both protagonists get to ride a Segway. Constant mini-games that are weirdly in-depth in their mechanics,
yeah,
and sometimes will lead to plot things going on. The two are hitting similar vibes for me.
Yeah, and that actually reminds me of where I was going, which was Echo also made that comparison. Was like, I'm getting the vibe that this is a Final Fantasy, like Yakuza-style game. And yeah, that there are similarities that can be made. I don't know what to make of it at the moment. Well, I do sort of. It's too much. I think that's my thing with it. It's so much different all the time. And yeah, it's more in-depth than it should be, or more in-depth than one expects. But because it's all crammed into something, nothing feels quite 100% fleshed out. It neither feels like you can like skip it and dispose of it, nor really get into something deep and complex. And instead, it's just this overwhelm of different gameplay, much of which often just sort of devolves into QTEs and the like, on top of this open world busy work that is some of the most shallow and vapid I've ever seen. I'm not saying that I'm not enjoying vast elements of it, but I'm fatigued by it. That's the word. That's the term that I keep coming back to playing it, content fatigue. I go to a new area, I'm like, this has opened up half a dozen different weird, stupid things, and I'm tired.
I do not blame you for feeling that way. I can totally see where you're coming from. I feel differently on it. I've been enjoying this as, I've made it to the third big area. I've made it to where you get the Segway and then, like, the next big area that sort of opens up. And
yeah.
My experience so far has very much been one of, I've been playing it through it with my lovely wife, Jane, and we have been 100%ing areas. And I don't know if we will persist at doing that, but we've been handing the game off back and forth and doing a little bit of, like, if either one of us is approaching that moment that might be fatigue, the other one takes over and they have their go. And I think that is keeping things novel enough in a way that if either one of us were doing twice as much of it, maybe wouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, the minigame stuff going on in it, I very much fall into the camp of, like, I am really invested in a lot of the weird side content. Queen's Blood, fucking great. I fucking love Queen's Blood.
I will
Blood.
Say,
Queen's Blood is fucking amazing.
I am fond of Queen's Blood. Every now and then I get fucking frustrated by it, but I never go like 100 fully percent into any of these Final Fantasy card games, but I always dabble, and I am enjoying this, and I think so far I may be a little bit ahead of you, but very close to you in terms of progress, and certainly in terms of the Queen's Blood, I've made sure to do all of those fights, and this is indicative of this fucking game. When you've played several Queen's Blood games and you've advanced in the rank, and then suddenly the feed cuts to a weird cutscene, an anime cutscene of some dude doing an overwrought monologue.
God. That was the moment I fucking fell in love with Queensblood. I know that that's not going to be for everyone, but I can tell you the moment it flashed me back to. It was me being like 10 or 11 years old and watching the Yu-Gi-Oh! Anime and watching the fictional creator of Yu-Gi-Oh! Go on a monologue about like, oh no, I've accidentally brought ancient gods from Egypt back to life by creating this card game. What have I done? I am evil.
Oh no, like, it's amazing.
It was perfectly recapturing a very specific flavor of melodrama that I was like, oh, perfect, give me more of this.
But I think that was also a very pivotal moment for me where I realized that this game, this whole experiment of theirs, has gone off the fucking rails in possibly the best way possible, possibly the most jaw-dropping train wreck of fucking nonsense. I mean, the reimagining of the Fort Condor strategy game as what it is in this, as that weird fucking Jumanji shit going on. And then the entire bit with, like, one of my favourite bits of Final Fantasy VII, the original, is I really throw away stupid optional scene at Costa del Sol where you go on the beach and there's Hojo, like, the sickest villain in the game, just on the beach, inexplicably surrounded by, like, women in his lab coat. And it is just such a ridiculously mundane thing to see this mad scientist out of place in. And I was hoping it would be in this. And of course, this game has lost its fucking mind. So what was this cute little throwaway scene that I always found adorable has become a giant fight with an octopus zoid that ends with the comic relief pervert being cloned multiple times and then turning into stuffed toys and exploding, which nobody questions. And when it comes up later that the clones are still alive and functional cloning technology has been created by accident, that's just shrugged off because that's mundane in this fucking world.
And you know what? I love every one of these fucking stupid things. I love
all of
it.
I feel like I've gone mad. Like, I genuinely feel like either myself or the world outside of my head. The two things can't exist on the same plane of sanity. Not this game and not me. And everyone seems to be just fine with this game existing. Which, again, don't get me wrong, this thing is a work of baffling genius. But the fact that nobody stopped this from happening makes me question the sanity of the world, because that thing is off its rocker.
Again, look, at its core, I think the thing that's holding this together and making me really enjoy it is that Remake Part 1 was very much go, 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 do the plot, go do the dramatic stuff. And there were side quests, but the side quests were, like, you know, little small things. The feeling I have about this second part is that they really, really, really want to go all in on this is the bit where you are going to spend time with your party members doing stuff that fleshes them out as people and spending time with them outside of just the constant rush toward the saving the world plot. I think there is something to be said for the bonkers nature of some of the shit that is available to do, and some of the cute little party interactions that come out of what the fuck is this all going on has done, in my opinion, a good job of leaning into that whole thing of trying to make these feel like people rather than just party members. And it is bonkers, it is ludicrous, and I am fucking loving it.
Yeah, like, I need to qualify what I'm saying with, like, this is not an attack on the game. I believe this game is an attack on human standards. Basically, what I'm trying to say is, like, I'm not attacking the game for this. I am simply stunned at it. Like, I am I'm in awe of this thing.
Again, I keep wanting to make that comparison to the Yakuza games, and I think it is the closest comparison I can make in games, which is it goes back and forth between very, very serious save the world plot and absolutely bonkers optional, but you should really put some time into its side content. And some of it's ridiculous, Some of it is baffling, but it's all part of a journey where by the end of it, I'm feeling pretty confident. I'm going to go, I sure went on a journey there. We all went on an adventure together. And sure, we're going to be trekking towards trying to save the world together. But also, do you remember that time where dogs did Rocket League?
My God.
Do you remember that? Do you remember Dog Rocket League? We all sure remember Dog Rocket League.
Yeah. Some of that... Don't introduce minigames as an optional thing, then introduce a thing that makes them compulsory, especially if I've tried it and felt like I was bored by it. I felt like I've done some unnecessary shit there, and I find a lot of the minigames very sort of tawdry, tedious, awkward to control. So that's where I'm finding the game bogged down by them. Sometimes I've just not wanted to play anymore because I've been in an area where I'm like, they've made me do all of these mini games, like one after the other, and I'm tired of it.
That's fair. I think if you absolutely hate Queen's Blood in particular, I think that like there is a moment where this game goes, Queen's Blood is optional. Wait, no, it's not. Do Queen's Blood for a while.
Luckily, I like Queen's Blood.
I love Queen's Blood, but I can see how people who don't like it would be specifically annoyed by that being made kind of mandatory for a bit.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think that needs to be said of the whole game. Like, if you do not want to play a whole bunch of minigames, don't play this game, because that's what it is. There is a main plot, and it is incredibly broken apart by this. I think that's another issue where, yes, I love all the bonkers nonsense, sort of. I'm at the very least like wowed by it. What I don't like is, and again, this is something I talk about so much in my reviews, where I talk about pacing, I talk about direction. When you are following a plot thread and the tone has whiplashed to something nonsense and it does so for ages, and then whiplashes back for a bit and then back at an inconsistent rate, and when the ratio of plot to utter nonsense that has nothing to do with the plot, either mechanically or narratively, when the ratio of that is skewed so much in favour of the side corn, I feel like it completely torpedoes any sense of pacing that the story has. And for me, that's possibly been the biggest problem this game has, which again, I'm enjoying it a lot, but I feel often like I've just really gotten into a plot moment, and then it's like, I've been booted back out, and I'm suddenly, like, I've been going through this, like, really awesome ride, and before I feel like it's over, I'm already in the novelty shop, and that has really sort of thrown apart my sort of ability to really invest and follow in the plot, because I keep getting pulled away.
There are two things I will say to that, one of which is, and this is not my experience, as I said, me and Jane have been, like, 100% heroes before we move on. I have seen people who have said similar thoughts of, but I want to be with the plot pacing, and have just ignored that side content and run for the plot, and apparently that is more doable than you would think. Now, that is not how my brain is built. I can't play it that way.
No, I struggle
as
well.
I see stuff to do and I have to go do stuff.
Yeah, even as someone complaining about it, the only thing I've not been, like, 100-ing on in each area while I'm in it at that moment are the fiend encounters, because some of those are just so hard to the point of not fucking fun that I've left some of those on the back burner and I've come back afterwards, which, God, why is fast travel so fucking convoluted and awkward? It's so fucking bad. But that's another thing with this game, is I've got some issues with its sort of fiddly menus, and the controls are really wonky. Trying to sprint with the chocobo, like, in the open world, and it's constantly, like, juddering because it's getting, like, caught and confused on the terrain bumps. It's so... It makes my skin crawl.
Not an experience I've had with it.
Oh. No, it's felt horrible.
The other thing I was going to say about that pacing is, yeah, some of this is just going to be very much down to personal taste on how you are with big side diversions in the middle of dramatic plot. And again, to keep making the one comparison I keep making, thinking about the most recent Yakuza game, Infinite Wealth, there is a point in that game where you are hot on the trail of your missing mother, and, like, every criminal faction in the world is trying to find where she's gone, and, like, you still don't know why the fuck everyone's after her. And then there's an Animal Crossing minigame pops up that you can go spend 12 hours doing Animal Crossing and fighting the washbucklers, the trash pirates who dump trash on your Animal Crossing island. And whether you hate that or love that, I think is going to be fairly telling of how you feel about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Are you the kind of person who, like me, will go, goody, here's an excuse to spend 12 hours not following the plot? Or will you go, yeah, but the plot was really good a minute ago, though I want back to that?
Well, I think that's the thing I've got to try and like work out what the differentiating factors are, because I love Yakuza. I've praised many of those games on this very podcast over the years to the nth degree, but there's something about the way they do it versus the way it's done here. I think part of it is the way it's done in Final Fantasy feels a little... It's a bit scattershot, haphazard, a bit copy-pasted at times, like especially things like the radio towers and stuff, where it's like, I'm walking across these expanses of nothing to press a button and then walk back, or fast travel to the next thing to press a button. So some of it is it's not... It's just not as engrossing and engaging up front as the stuff in Yakuza. And the stuff in Yakuza is just... It's better written, better paced, snappier. Yeah. I think it's just a difference in quality that leads to a difference in my ability to gel with it and find that it is an elegantly woven into the game rather than a constant contradiction.
I also wonder if part of it is expectation, not just in comparison to the original Final Fantasy VII not doing this with its sort of tone and pacing, but also with part one of the remake not doing so. It's, you know, you go into a Yakuza game knowing what to brace for in terms of the weird mix of things that will be. And there is definitely something to be said of this, both compared to what it's being a remake of and what it's a sequel to, sort of throwing this a little unexpectedly necessarily at the player.
I think that's a really good point. When we look at the first one, when we look at Final Fantasy Remake, because it had a bit more of a linear structure, the nonsense that it did have felt a little more contained. It felt like it was off the beaten path, but it didn't feel like it was like kicking you off onto big sprawling other paths. And it wasn't a lot of like nebulous open world busy work shit, which of course I'm usually pretty harsh on. And I think that really helped that sense of pacing, was there was that sense of linearity that meant it didn't get away from itself. It didn't lose focus too much in terms of what it was trying to cram in. And I think that's another thing this one does that the first one didn't, is this one really is just trying to throw in as much as possible. It's like someone told them, this might be the last video game you ever make. If you have any ideas for games, get them in now, because at the end of this, we're all taking cyanide. Like we've signed this deal with Square Enix. This isn't a game development project. This is a suicide pact. You got ideas, smoke them while you got them.
It feels like there's a degree of, we know that we will be given the money to make this, and that people will play it. And there is a certain degree of, if there is...
Like, there is a sense, not to cut in, but I just gotta say, like, there is that sense of, we got away with this once. Like, I know that's not what you mean, but when you say that, it really is like, we got away with this, we can do whatever we want.
Well, the point I was trying to get to is, because they know, like, money is no object, people will play this and people will put eyes on it, it feels like there is a degree of, look, development team who has been doing stuff a little bit by the numbers, do you have ideas of stuff you want to play around with? Fuck it, here's your playground, do all the fun stuff you want to do, because we might not get another game where we have the sort of budget freedom to play around with ideas that otherwise would have to be put on that pile of, that's not a core feature, we have to leave it behind. I have respect for recognizing you have your opportunity to do weird little shit. And to be a bit experimental.
I love it and hate it. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, I will be playing it for a while, getting really annoyed, where I'm like, I do not want to do... Why are you making me... Why am I suddenly doing squats? I've just done a whole town of minigames. I finally got into an open world area, and you've put me into a minigame where we're doing squats suddenly. The pacing is off. This is so annoying. And then after about, I'd say every 15 minutes of me feeling like that will be followed by 10 minutes of me just straight up grinning at how stupid this is. at what they've done. And so I am, like, flitting wildly between exasperation and utter joy that it's almost got. You know, when I was talking about the Barbie film a few weeks ago, and I was, like, expressing my joy that can still exist in this world, that people will let someone take this established property and fuck it up in the most entertaining way possible. Every time I remember that this is supposed to be a remake of one of the most beloved, critically acclaimed and commercially successful games of all time, I have to burst out laughing. Because part of me wonders if like me 10 years ago wouldn't be so completely fucking offended by this game and consider it blasphemy. But me today, cynical, bitter, fucking past it and done, I am just delighted that someone looked at Final Fantasy VII and thought, you know that? I can fucking ruin that in the best way possible. And they did.
I fall a lot more on the positive end than you do, but I get a lot of it. But I will say this.
I'm being really positive, by the way. Like, yeah. I am really beaming.
The thing I keep thinking about as a thought is, and I think we're far enough away from Part 1 Remake to get a little into this. Part 1 Remake has a whole plot point that grows toward the end about being allowed to make changes to what Final Fantasy VII is. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, the assumption was that we were talking about, like, big, major plot point changes. Like, having not gotten that far into Remake Part 2, you know, I don't know the answer to this, but, like, you know, the questions of whether certain characters will survive or not. And I'm now loving the thought that the entire, like, oh, we're creating this entire narrative conceit of these, like, ghosts that are trying to be like, oh, no, oh, you've got to let canon change, was all nothing to do with big, like, plot changes, and all to do with we want to be able to put Dog Rocket League in.
It was Queen's Blood.
Blood all along. All of those robed ghosts wanted to let Queen's Blood exist. That was the change to the canon that was being permitted.
Final Fantasy Remake was nothing but one long establishing selling point for the sequel, Queen's Blood, The Chadley Chronicles. This is the game that they were making. That first game was the wind-up. This is the pitch. A game in which a little boy with the gayest boy shorts imaginable constantly harasses you in between card games until a dog plays Rocket League.
You're talking about the person with the femme alternate persona who definitely we shouldn't read into her existence. Definitely not a phase some of us have been through.
Chadley shorts are the gayest thing I've ever seen, and I've seen me. I can't get over what a tidy little queer he looks like.
Look, Chadley, it's okay to just be my all the time. No one's gonna judge you for that. It's okay. You can do it.
Might be a case that Chadley and Mai are Mai and Chadley. Like, it could very much be a duality thing. In which case, like, get it on. But whatever you do, whether you are Mai forever or Chadley or a combination of the two, always have one look in your repertoire that is tiny little, like, blue boy shorts and socks pulled up real high.
Oh.
He's such a smart little gay boy. I wish you'd shut up. Both personas. There's nothing more annoying than, like, playing one of those really hard fiend battles and my controller is, like, yelling at me in that woman's voice, and I can't even hear her, but she's just shouting at me.
Oh, you completed that match, but it looks like you didn't complete all the objectives.
And then at the end,
yes,
she does that.
I fucking know I failed. I know I failed the fucking objectives. I'm on attempt 7. You can stop telling me I failed to get the stun state on.
Yeah, I killed it before I staggered it. Shut up. So yes, it's a hell of a thing.
I'm in love with it.
You see, the first one I've been very vocal in my praise for. I think it was a work of genius. At the very least, it was the setup. It was a brilliant setup that I always said will take the rest of the installments to show whether it was genius or a prelude to madness. Right now, I'm on the fence. I'm a prelude to mad genius. But I am not yet decided whether it is one or the other. it is starting to look like some bizarre cacophonous meld of the two.
This has been such a good year for big, long, weird JRPGs with a lot of bonkers side content. I am eating up.
It's a fucking ride. I mean, it is a ride. That is one thing I can't take away from it. I haven't seen the general consensus. I don't look at a lot of community discussion lately. My guess is there's a lot of thoughts similar to both of us, probably.
I haven't looked at a lot of response to it. I've deliberately, this has just been my, like, not rushing through it for work, yeah. Just playing through with the missus game. But I do know that, critically, it is the second highest rated Final Fantasy game ever on Metacritic.
Oh, God!
I believe it's averaging a 94 on Metacritic.
It shouldn't do. But it should. Like, the fact it shouldn't do is why it should. This should be the highest rated Final Fantasy game of all time. It should be one of the highest rated video games of all time. Precisely because it shouldn't be. Because it isn't, as a game, it isn't that great. But as a collective work of madness, it is transcendent. And the fact that I don't think it deserves to be as rated as high as it is also part of why I love it. Because people shouldn't be loving this thing. I shouldn't love it as much as I do. I'd go as far as to say it's actually really bad. But in a way that makes it really brilliant. I have very complex... I've just started to realise the more I talk about it, how complex my thoughts about this game are.
I've just had a quick look. It is in the 90s from critics average. It's averaging about an 8 out of 10 from audiences. And Metacritic is what, you know, what it is what it is.
Yeah, but yeah.
That is a lot less all over the place than I would have expected it to be.
The fact that it isn't divisive, there is something fascinating in that. Because this should be. And again, it's part of what makes this game so brilliant is that everything about it, what it's doing as a game, and on meta levels like this, everything about it to me is a confusing paradox. This should be so divisive. People should be saying, what the fuck is this? What is this utter shit that is making a deliberate, at times, joke at the expense of the original and the people who like it and the people playing this? And yet, even me, who probably is going to end up the most critical person talking about it, even I have to couch everything I'm saying about it with, it's also brilliant, it's also genius.
Well, we waffled about that for a bit. Comrade, you played anything this week?
Yeah, I've played a couple of things. I was on Twitch, I opened the window or something, and there was this panel that had popped up with channels playing Supermarket Simulator. So I'm thinking that this one might be like another one of these short-term simulator bubbles that everybody's playing for a week or two.
Yeah.
It's an early access. I checked it out. It is what's on the tin, I guess. It's a first-person presented affair. You have a small shop that's about the size of a bodega to start with a couple of sets of shelves and a computer and a cash register. And you order products on the computer. They get shipped and dropped immediately in boxes out in front of your shop where you can go collect them and decide what shelves to put on them and then set the prices on the items on the shelves. And it tells you what the current market rate is. And of course, you know how much you spent on them. And so calculate your profits. And then you can go and open up your thing, and time passes and customers come in and they pick up the things and they bring them to the register and you scan them, and then you can, they pay cash or card. Of course, some people will pay card for a $1.99 purchase. That's just the way life is. They give you a card, you have to click on the card in their hand, and then it immediately goes into the card reader slot where you have to enter the amount on the register that they have to pay. This is my first point of contention with this. I get what they're doing. I understand that, yes, you have to punch in the numbers on the little touch screen. And that's fine. fine. I get it. But for fuck's sake, you let me use the numeric keypad when I was setting prices on my shelves. I hate having to tap on that damn screen. Not least because this game pretends at being able to be playable with controller, but isn't really. Like, you can move physically and move the camera, and you can jump when using the controller, but I can't find key mapping to do any other interaction. So it's fucking useless. And so I'm mousing, having to tap over these things, and it requires a bit more accuracy than you'd like. Like, it simulates using a touch screen on one of those cheap POS systems pretty well, but I hate it. I much prefer when people give me cash, because then it goes over to the other little register, and I have to, you know, dispense the exact change. And that's really fun. It made me kind of miss retail, because there's a little bit of a game to that, and doing that efficiently. And what's your approach? Do you go large bills to small? Do you go small bills to large? How do you calculate out your coins?
This is triggering so much anxiety.
As someone
who struggles with like money management and is you know, has dyscalculia and can't do numbers and shit, like everything you're saying is terrifying. My blood has run cold.
I get a real kick out of it. It's very like springy as the, you know, you click on the areas of the cash register and the dollar bills fly out onto the counter and the coins, and then once you've got it all, you hit space, and you know, it's really fun to hit that last one and immediately hit space and close the drawer because you know you nailed it. That I love giving change in this game. And so as it progresses and people are coming up and buying things, of course, it's depleting your stock. So you might have to stop real quick and go make an order for more cereal, you know, and then run out to the street, grab the box and fill it on the shelves while people are still shopping and occasionally waiting at the register. And you don't want them to wait too long, obviously. They're the priority. So you go and you have to take it. It's a bunch of little management. There does come a point where, you know, you add fridges and freezers, you expand the store. I've got a couple of fridges, one for beverages, one for dairy. Your product line continues to expand as you buy licenses. You have to pay rent and electrical utilities. It's all, you know, but it's not, none of it feels overwhelming in terms of like the economic pressure. It feels overwhelming in the middle of the day when you're out of cheese and you've got three people in line and you know at least two of them wanted cheese. And you can't fulfill that because you don't have time to get over and do the ordering. And, oh, it's heartbreaking. I'm looking forward to being able to add a staff member who will be able to operate the cash register for me. And then I can do all the stocking and inventory. And that'll just take a huge load off. But my store is becoming so popular that, like, the number of customers coming through and the amount of purchases that they're making is becoming a bit of a burden also. It's a good problem to have. A bad problem to have is motion sickness. And I don't know what happened. I played this game last night on my stream. I played it for 2 hours, and I took a break, and I came back, and I sat down, and I started the next day. You know, I'd done 7 days prior to this, and immediately, for some reason, the camera decided, no, we're going to make you feel violently ill from this game. I find the mouse camera control to be a little too fiddly, even on a significantly lowered sensitivity. And it did a number on me. I'm not usually the sort to get this from games. I get it in vehicles. I'm very, very motion sick in any car, even like a ride to the bus station to go somewhere else. I'll have to take Dramamine, not for the bus, for the car. But games typically doesn't happen. I can't remember the last first-person game that gave me motion sickness. This did a fucking number on me. To the point where now, you know, I was making such progress and feeling so good about the way the game was going, and now I'm very, very hesitant to go back after that experience. It was truly awful. That's deeply unfortunate because I think the game is pretty fun. I wasn't trying to gouge on prices. I was keeping everything just a little below market rate, figuring that that would increase my volume and I'd make decent profit just as well that way without trying to be exploitative. But, you know, prices will change in the market day by day. There's some mechanics going on under the hood. I like it. I don't think I can play it anymore, and that's a real shame. But, you know, it's cute. It's going to be another one of these, I think, for a week or two where people are playing and maybe check someone else out playing it. It's fun. I like these sort of sims, and I like it when they get businessy. And this is doing that. It's doing that for me. I wish I could have a cat. Like, I wish I could never expand the size of my store larger than it is right now, just the one register, and a pack it full of shelves, and get a cat. I just want a bodega simulator.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
You don't want to ramp up the capitalism, you want to wrap up the cat-pitalism.
Yes, there, oh. What else have you played, Laura?
I've been playing a bit of a game that Steph's been playing some of as well. You've been playing more of it than I have, but we've played some of it together. We've been playing the Outlast Trials.
I get a bloody review code for something, and then I can't play it because it's completely online and very... No one was playing it because it wasn't out. So I got a code for you, Laura. We were able to play together for a little bit and had fun.
Yeah, we got a few hours in.
So
together.
Yeah, the Outlast Trials, it's an interesting one, just as a pitch. What if Outlast played exactly like Outlast, but there's four of you in a multiplayer scenario? With the exact same limitations. You're all still hiding from guys, like, and just trying to, like, collect keys and turn on generators, you know, all the usual sort of horror palaver. With that kind of Outlast distinct style, that kind of grimy, horrible, dirty atmosphere that those games have. Where, like, I didn't like the second Outlast, but I really liked the first. But my god, those games are some of the least pleasant to be in, environmentally. They're so perfectly horrible. And the ones in this are kind of stylistically quite beautiful on top in a kind of ghastly, gory way. There are some really, like, almost beautifully framed, gory set pieces for these arenas.
Yeah, because the concept for this that sets up those arenas is a whole thing, because I'm going to butcher the premise here, but I'm going to do my best of it. Some flyers are distributed being like, hey, do you have no money and need money? Come see us. And people are basically like, oh, hey, burn all of the records you've ever existed and join our religiously charged Christian sort of themed series of saw traps and work your way to moral absolution through visiting locations we filled full of mannequins and cardboard cutouts and occasionally a murderous person. That's basically the gist, if I remember right.
Sort of, yeah. It's basically sort of, what if the guys that got Deadpool were also running a hostile version of, The Krypton Factor! I had a great cultural reference lined up then. The Krypton Factor by way of Hostel, set up like the way Ajax got Deadpool in that little tank.
Because it's all like practical sets you've been dropped into, where it's like, you know, some of it's filled in with like cardboard cutouts, but some of it's like, there's one I'm thinking of where we had to break into an orphanage and like tune all the radios to like religious radio stations or something. But like, there were these sort of robot nuns that were running around that were on tracks, and like a theme park, as the nun got toward a door, the door would automatically open, because it's all just a little automated set place.
Yeah, every level has its sort of, like, it's clearly some sort of disused facility, or they've taken some disused building. Everything is some rundown, dilapidated shithole that they've then dressed up with dioramas and mannequins and scenery.
They've put a story into the room. Yeah, the killers can be within, but you know, it's like there's a plot happening around the killing.
Yeah, so the first trial is like you've got to kill a prison snitch, and they've done up this facility a bit like a prison. They've got this guy, this sort of like dirty prison guard with a cattle prod wandering around, and some dude that they've, you know, put a bag on his head, tied him up to a chair, and you've got to break in and get him out of his cell and unlock all these doors and push him on his chair to eventually electrocute him, all of this shit. But yeah, it's all surrounded by mannequins dressed up like cops, and the orphanage has that one sort of enemy who is the leather-faced woman with the with the drill puppet beak.
The puppet with the drill in its mouth.
Yeah, yeah, the puppet drill duck.
The way you describe it, it's giving, like, rural but very creative, like, Halloween haunted house company.
Yes. Yeah. It feels like, what if you set a couple of actual killers loose in a fake haunted house that was, like, a very well-done fake haunted house, but, like, someone turned the lights up enough you could see the tracks things were moving on.
Or if, say, like, Jigsaw tried to go legit, make a real theme park, and got it really wrong.
What, you're not meant to make the patrons throw beating hearts at the projectiles? Oh, no.
Fuck, I tell you what I've done, mate. I tell you what I've done.
Ride the teeth ride.
I tell you what I've done, boss. I fucking made a death trap again. Fuck, shit. I realised that this was supposed to be a haunted house, right? Yeah, I shouldn't have used real electricity. That's my bad.
Jigsaw trying to go legit is the best way to describe it, though, because, like, that level, the scariest thing in there was not particularly dangerous to you, player, but it was just a roller coaster ride full of teeth. And that was more unsettling than anything else.
Horrible dental-themed roller coaster where the walls are made of gums and teeth are jutting out of the flesh. And there are these horrible little, like, dioramas of model teeth being yanked. And it's grotesque. And it's just, it's not even meant to be real in the game. It's supposed to be, you know, paper mache and set. And yet, it's some of the most disgusting shit I've ever seen in a game. And I hate it. And I admire that. It's vile. The game itself, I'm looking forward to, now that it's been out, I missed the launch day, but once we're done here, I'll have to check it out. I'm looking forward to playing it with some full teams, see what that's like. I haven't disliked it. I've enjoyed it quite a bit. It weirdly, at least in the two-player games we've had, it translated weirdly well. I've tried playing it solo. Some of them are pretty doable solo, the smaller ones, the big trial levels. It just takes so long to do everything, and even though it is technically possible, it's tedious on your own, because there's so much running around looking for keys and clues, that having more people to cover that ground, just having you, Laura, got me through, like, things literally twice as quick, so...
Yeah.
You know.
And sometimes it's just helpful to be like, hey, can you just run around visibly in front of the monster for a minute so I can get shit done?
Yes, the ability to use one of you as a distraction is invaluable, which again really shows the weakness of the game when you're on your own, because it ends up with so much being caught running, hiding in a bin, waiting for them to go, and it's so two steps forward, one step back. Whereas with multiple players, one of you can get like in the orphanage, we ended up in one part where you had both enemies that were patrolling both sides of the building were both on you, which allowed me to waste all of that free time not finding the thing I was trying to find. But if I'd have found it, that would have been a great time saver. So little things like that, I think, it almost feels like the introduction of more players doesn't change the way Outlast as a game plays. It makes it quicker. What it does is you're just as helpless in a way, but because you can solve puzzles quicker and because you can get enemies off of each other when one of you's trying to do something, not with complete reliability, but with enough, it is almost like a more bite-sized Outlast. And it works, I think. Not when you play it on your own. The first time I played it on my own, I did get through it, and it took me 75 minutes to do a fucking mission that could have been done in 15. But...
yeah, I tried a bit of it single-player, and I agree with you very much.
Yeah. It's a bit of a... It's just not very viable on its own.
Yeah.
But as a team thing, just this weird sort of fast-paced Outlast with the ability to decorate your little cell between missions and put in a little toy robot, or what they call a sex toy, and it's just this horrible fat finger on the end of a Hitachi attachment type of thing, and it looks horrible and industrial and heavy and not fun or attractive at all. But I bought it for 250, like, I don't know, mental patient coins or whatever it is.
250, you've done some good redemption missions.
You've done some stuff.
Bucks.
Yeah. Stuff bucks.
You've become a better person, dollars.
Yeah. Like, I've gotten some upgrades. There's nothing too fancy. It's like, hey, here is a slide. You can do a little slide when you sprint and duck and stuff like that. And there are these rigs, these rechargeable devices that you can unlock and carry one of those with you. And they're on a cooldown. One of them is a healing rig, which is just obviously what it sounds like. You can do a little group heal. And there's one that can give you like x-ray vision to see enemies, and one that does like a smoke screen. Like, just, there's four of them. I forget the other one. Maybe a stun trap or something. None of them like lethal or combative, but certainly the healing one is fucking invaluable at times. That's the one I went for before I tried any of the others, and I've not wanted to try any of the others because the health one is so useful. It's an interesting game, and not an unenjoyable one.
It's the most I've ever enjoyed an Outlast.
Yeah.
It's not usually a series for me, and I had decent fun with this.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, they took an idea that when you first hear it, you're like, how the fuck is that gonna work? And then when you play it, you're like, oh, quite simply.
Yeah. Yeah, what about you, Conrad? You played anything else this week?
Warhammer, Bolt Gun. Wound up on Game Pass.
Hello.
And I did start playing that, and oh, it is. It's delightful. Just, I mean, we talked about it months ago, and you know, I remember watching Steph playing it and being just like, or maybe it was Casey Explosion I saw playing it. And being very enamored by its aesthetic and the gameplay.
Yeah, I did stream it, and I do like it. I think it should have ended hours before it does, but yeah, what did you think?
Well, that's kind of where I'm feeling it too, because I'm like five levels into the first chapter, and I'm feeling like there's three chapters in this, and that's too many chapters.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's not that it isn't fun. I love, they capture the tone of Warhammer as I want it depicted so perfectly.
Yes.
You know, and to be clear, there are lots of ways you could portray Warhammer 40K, but this is the one I want, where it just goes that little extra bit into how silly this all really is, and does that fantastically well.
You have a button to judge.
Yeah.
I always come back to that. There is literally a hurl space fascism rhetoric button.
And I use it frequently.
Yeah, yeah.
I never fully forget it's there. It's more like occasionally I remember.
Yeah.
Right? And then I hit it a couple of times as I'm making my way to wherever it is I'm trying to go. The levels are well laid out. My first-person shooter brain isn't well suited to them, so I get lost a fair bit. It is definitely better than most of these games that I've played that try to reflect 90s-style first-person shooters. Their levels are, geographically, they feel cohesive in a way that I can identify some landmarks and usually remember where I need to go to get to where I am, or can recognize when I'm walking in the wrong direction, which is nice, but it's still a bit of a struggle for me occasionally. But I like walking into an area expecting a fight, but not expecting the extent to which the fight is going to be. Because you'll come into these areas occasionally, and there are some sparsely laid out enemies across a huge area, and you think, oh, I'm traversing. And then all of a sudden you get in there, and they start warping in so much shit, and it just becomes a mad scramble. And that is really satisfying and fun. I'm of two minds on the movement. The character, generally speaking, moves faster than I feel a Space Marine should. But at the same time, whenever they're using their movement abilities, like the quick zip or the chain sword closing a gap, that feels really right to me. But it just, it also has to try and get that Doom sense, and I get it.
It's one of those acceptable compromises, I think. Yeah. Like, you notice it's there, and I understand what you mean. And they kind of, they try and compensate for that with the camera bob and the thuddy kind of sound. And I think that goes some way towards, like, keeping that illusion going. But no, I see what you mean, and I think given the choice, I'll go with what they went with.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, no, yeah. It's not bad. It's not a bad experience, but it is one of those things that as I'm moving around, it's just sort of niggling in the back of my mind, being like, this doesn't quite feel right, but it's fun, so I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
But even now, you know, like 5 stages in, I'm starting to feel like the loop is, well, this is what the loop is now, and I've done it a fair bit. And I know that I have just sort of more of this to look forward to. And it's quickly going to, it's going to be probably 3 levels into chapter 2 where I say, all right, I've had enough fun with this. And I'm not going to feel bad about it because I will have thoroughly enjoyed the time up to that point. God, the visuals are great. The character designs are phenomenal. I love when I walk into an area and there's a few base enemies and they just scream at my presence. Like, even if they have theoretically the jump on me and the the ambush opportunity is there, they still have to scream in horror at my presence before they could do anything. And I love it. Yeah. It's really fun, and now that it's on Game Pass, if you have Game Pass, it would be a good time to check it out. I'm glad I didn't pay additional money to play it, but I'm really glad that I'm playing it. Anybody else?
That's everything I've played this week.
I am playing something else, which actually is another, weirdly, review copy, but I don't think I can talk about it yet.
I can't talk about anything else I've played, so should we do a little bit of new stuff and then finish up?
Yeah, why not?
Sure. The video game industry doesn't know how to fucking learn lessons, apparently. And that's just, like, generally a statement, but it's also a particular, story that's come up this week. If we think about Warner Brothers games over the last year, I feel like a pretty big trend has emerged, you know, for better or worse, as much as, you know, I have my opinions on the fucking game. Hogwarts Legacy, single player game, sold really fucking well. Suicide Squad, live service game, sold very fucking poorly from all accounts. Now, one would imagine Warner Brothers would look at that and go, maybe we make more single player games and fewer big live service things. That's not the lesson they learned from that.
Of course not.
No. Warner Brothers Discovery Gaming boss J.B. Perrette wants to move away from single-player games and toward more live services.
Of course. Makes sense.
We're doubling down on games as an area where we think there is a lot more growth opportunity that we can tap into with the IP that we have and some of the capabilities we have on the studio, where we're uniquely positioned as both a publisher and developer of games.
We found some more dust in these udders, is what he's saying.
This is where he gets into it. Rather than just launching a one-and-done console game, how do we develop a game around, for example, a Hogwarts Legacy or Harry Potter that is live service, where people can live and work and build and play in that world on an ongoing basis? Sir, do you not realise you made a single-player game that sold well and a live service that sold badly, and you're like, what if we take the thing that did well and put it in the genre that did bad?
Well, the problem was the setting, obviously. It wasn't the live service bit. Everybody wants the Hogwarts setting, and if they could only just have that in a live service... Like that,
of course.
It's the booking. To bring the wrestling parlance back into this, you have had so many situations where you get like WCW putting the championship on Sting in the early 90s, and attendance was going down at WCW, and it was still going down when they put the championship on Sting. And did they stop and think, maybe we have, like, booked a terrible show that people don't want to come and see? They go, no, Sting's the champion. That's what's wrong. We'll keep booking this shit, and we'll put it on Ric Flair. And that's exactly what I'm seeing with this, where it's like, it's Suicide Squad. That's the problem. It's not the game that people don't want. It's the champion. It's the one we put in the title. Let's take Hogwarts, which people like, and put that in the game that people didn't like. Then people were like, it's so fucking stupid.
What if we take a genre people aren't digging and put just the right name on it? Will that fix it? Can we then run the money machine?
Yeah, name value is important, obviously, but so is applying that name to something that people want to play, to something that fits the whatever the intellectual property. And this speaks volumes about Warner Brothers in general. Again, the company that decided Game of Thrones and Scooby-Doo should exist in the same universe. Their idea, Warner Brothers, is like offensive lack of care when it comes to the context of its own media, the context of its own art. This is just more of that. They don't understand, or they don't give a shit about what any of the IP they have bought up and gobbled up means. They only care about how much can we squeeze from it. And they don't think about doing that in a way that actually appeals or plays to the strengths of the IP they've bought. They just want to bend everything they have to fit their preconceived notions and the things they already want, which, again, that leads to something else I've ranted about in the industry before, where companies, executives, will decide on a result and then issue statements telling us that that's what the result is, whether that's happened or not. Fittingly enough, an example being single player is dead, like what we see here, where it's like, oh yeah, no one wants that, let's make it a live service. It's like, no, people did want it, they bought it. And we keep seeing this, executive saying people don't want the thing that they literally just said they wanted, because we want them to have something else, and we're going to tell you you want that too.
Yes, because the other thing represents significantly more profit opportunity to them.
Well, of course.
That's what they're looking at. They are assuming success in a medium that has repeatedly demonstrated that the odds of success are significantly stacked against you, and that there can really only be two or three of these things that succeed on the level that you want. And they're entrenched.
We're literally seeing the results of that now. Like, yeah. The several Jimquisition videos this year have already been about this. The companies that are throwing so many of these games out. At this point, with me suspecting they have to know they're not succeeding at this point, they're just throwing them out and seeing what sticks. And it's not a sustainable way to do things with your big IP and in your big budget game.
And it's not to say that making a single-player game based on a big IP is going to be a guaranteed success.
No.
By no means is that to be.
But we at least know people want them, in general.
Yes, we know people want them, and we know that the investment required to complete that, the risk-reward of that proposition, is safer.
And particularly in this example, because, like, you know, anything else aside, if you, in any other industry, went, cool, we developed a thing, it sold 22 million copies, what if we use those assets and make a sequel? That would be, like, the most sensible fucking trajectory ever. And instead, what they went was, what if we did something that is a complete and utter risk might not work instead, but if it does, it could be an infinite money machine.
These people are gamblers. I mean, yeah. They all are. They're gamblers.
And what's funny is, they're so gambling averse, and their fear of gambles makes them constantly bet on what they think are dead certs, based purely on the fact that they've thought about the result and not what it takes to get there. So yes. Not only are they gamblers, they're dumb, cowardly gamblers as well.
I mean, they're just bad at calculating the odds in a lot of circumstances. And they are looking at the huge win opportunity because they're the special boy that's going to win. For them, it's not really a risk because they're going to eliminate jobs. I mean, that's the chips are other people's lives, and that has no value to them. So look forward to more live service failures followed by more layoffs.
Yep. Other stories we got this week. This one happened incredibly fucking fast in its rise and fall. There's a Nintendo Switch emulator that exists called Yuzu.
We spoke a little bit about this last week.
Yeah, we mentioned last week that Nintendo would threaten to sue Yuzu, basically going, hey, your emulator facilitates piracy, get rid of it. And specifically going into, like, the things that were looking bad for Yuzu, Nintendo's claims were very specifically, hey, your emulator is behind a paywall, so you're making money from this emulator. You are advertising your Patreon explicitly on the back of, it will run this pirated game better, so you are explicitly tying pirated use cases to the money you are making on the emulator, including advertising builds behind that paywall that will let you play unreleased games before they are released, which is not a good look. And specifically on top of that, screenshots suggested that the people who make Yuzu were doing the one thing you are never supposed to do if you run an emulator, which is giving people instructions on how to get the keys that are required to make the emulator run pirated software.
Yeah, that's a big no-no.
Yeah, like, the way that, like, these things go is that you run that emulator and you go, this does not play pirated games without this file, a file of this name. It's up to you. That's nothing to do with us.
Yeah.
Whereas Yuzu were found to, on their Discord, be hosting instructions on how to access those keys, which, like, that's like four things you don't fucking do as an emulator if you want to not get in legal trouble.
Well, because that's where the violation of the DMCA comes in. When you are instructing people how to circumvent the protections on the hardware, that is illegal. And yes, that's where you get fucked.
Yeah. So, very quickly, in the scheme of lawsuits, in the space of a week, the creators of Yuzu have settled with Nintendo for $2.4 million. They've taken Yuzu offline, alongside its source code, agreed to pay $2.4 million to Nintendo, and have published a statement regarding things. I do want to stop and read it. It's the most hilarious fucking statement I have ever seen. I do not believe that anyone at Yuzu believes any words in this statement.
I have it right here.
Ah, okay, yeah. Do you want to jump into it?
I'd love to. And I would like to, I would very much like for people to just in your heads visualize a grainy camera footage of a largely empty room and a single person sitting in a chair with maybe a flag behind them with a Nintendo logo on it. Just so we have the scene. Hello, users and Citra fans. We write today to inform you that Yuzu and Yuzu's support of Citra are being discontinued, effective immediately. Just for clarity, Citra is their 3DS emulator.
Yes, and we'll get to talking about that in a minute, because I think that's maybe the biggest story.
Yuzu and its team have always been against piracy. We started the projects in good faith, out of passion for Nintendo and its consoles and games, and we're not intending to cause harm. But we see now that because our projects can circumvent Nintendo's technological protection measures and allow users to play games outside of authorized hardware, they have led to extensive piracy. In particular, we have been deeply disappointed when users have used our software to leak game content prior to its release and ruin the experience for legitimate purchasers and fans. We have come to the decision that we cannot allow this to occur. Piracy was never our intention, and we believe that piracy of video games and on video game consoles should end. Effective today, we will be pulling our code repositories offline, discontinuing our Patreon accounts and Discord servers, and soon, shutting down our websites. We hope our actions will be a small step toward ending piracy of all creators' works.
I've never believed less of a statement I've ever heard.
Yeah, that is one of the least sincere things on the planet.
Oh, we are deeply saddened to realize that our emulator allowed piracy to occur, and we really hope we can be an important step on the road to ending piracy, a thing that we never wanted to see.
It is such a gun to the head statement.
You telling me this death trap killed someone? Because that is not actually what I made this for.
Yeah.
So, did you say someone sat in that chair and then you pulled that lever, and it electrocuted. No, mate. No, that is not what my electric chair is designed to do. Fuck. I don't, effective immediately, right? I'm changing the plug head on that.
So, look, there's a few things going on here. This is where I get into the realm of discussing speculation and things that are a little more poorly sourced. But there is some discussion doing the rounds as to maybe why Yuzu was so quick to agree to a settlement. And it sure seems like there might be some things in Yuzu's closet that they do not want coming out in discovery, because they would make this a much bigger fucking problem for Yuzu. Some of the allegations doing the rounds are that people on the creative team at Yuzu were not just creating an emulator that was capable of running pirated software, but in some cases Yuzu staff members were the ones getting cartridges early, ripping the ROMs, making the ROMs available online. At the very least, distributing the ROMs amongst themselves. There are things like this that are not very well evidenced right now, but there are screenshots doing the rounds that seem to be legitimate, and the sentiment seems to be they did not want that shit going to discovery. They just wanted to be, like, get the fuck out before this gets worse. And it is worth noting that because this didn't go to trial, this hasn't created any kind of new precedent. This has not in any way legally changed the situation as we currently understand it around emulators. Nintendo has not shown any intention currently of going after any other emulators, and the other major Nintendo Switch emulator, Ryujinx, does not have a Patreon, does not do specific builds like, hey, here's the build so that you can play Tears of the Kingdom before its release date. They don't distribute, like, give information on where to find the files needed to make their emulator work. They're doing all the shit that Yuzu was not doing.
It's unfortunate that pretty well-made software was made by people with bad OPSEC.
Yes, very much so. The thing that I think is the bigger part of the story is the fact that Nintendo doesn't seem to have requested legally that this happen. This seems to be Yuzu's creators just trying to avoid any further problems. They are also the creators of an emulator called Citra, which is the primary 3DS emulator. And the reason why I think this is a bigger story, because they've taken Citra offline as well, is that Yuzu going away isn't the end of the world, in as much as there is another emulator that is arguably more reliably usable than Yuzu in Ryujinx. Citra is really the only 3DS emulator of any real note out there. Specifically, Citra has been pulled offline mere months after the ability to legally purchase 3DS games through the eShop was taken away. This is a legacy system that does not have a way to legally purchase new digital games, that no longer has a way to access that software that is no longer available, you know, through the eShop, via an emulator. That sucks for preservation. It also really sucks for accessibility. I know people who cannot play games on a 3DS because screen size or form factor are accessibility barriers to them, for whom the ability to play on a larger screen using something like an accessibility controller is the only way those games are playable, and that is no longer an option. It really fucking sucks that Citra is gone. That being said, in theory, Yuzu and Citra are open source projects. People have the source code for those projects. It is not unreasonable to expect that forked versions or branch versions of those emulators will pop up, or that people will use the work and the source code that exists to create replacements, and hopefully be a little less fucking stupid about how they run them.
I think that's likely to happen. That we'll probably see two or three 3DS emulators arise out of this, like, you know, a Hydra situation. So it's not all bad news. I think this will survive, especially because there is no alternative, really. Yeah. That Citra is going to see new life somewhere else. You know, Yuzu, we'll see. I really liked it as an emulator. I thought it was pretty user-friendly, but I also think a lot of the advantage of Yuzu was in how quickly it was receiving updates and correcting for issues that people were having with software shortly after release. And so I would anticipate that not being the expectation going forward for any sort of fork, which is a shame.
Mm.
But Ryujinx is great software.
Ryujinx very reliably functions and doesn't need updates to make it function when new stuff happens. And Ryujinx is our workhorse. But Citra is the one I'll be keeping an eye out for if anything surfaces in its wake. But yeah, hey, if you're running an emulator, don't fucking learn from this one.
Yep.
Don't do the shit that got this one in trouble. It's like when people are making fan games based on properties they don't own. Don't fucking do trailers. Just release the fan project when it's ready, and at that point it's kind of too late.
Yeah.
Right, just fucking act that way about this shit.
You will got. Like, that...
Yeah.
And I'm saying this as someone who once had an incredible Pokemon shirt for sale. No matter how small you think you are, no matter how, like, cheeky you think it is, they don't care.
Yeah.
It's all infringement to them, and they treat it all the same.
Just stay fucking quiet and don't be fucking loud about the fact that you are doing the shit that will get you in trouble and historically has gotten emulator people in trouble, so...
Yeah, and if you're fine with that, you know, if you're like, we're going to put out this fan game or this emulator or whatever, it will get shut down. If you're fine with that, just be smart to ensure that you are keeping it, like, up and available for as long as possible. Yeah. And unfortunately, some of that does involve, like, being smarter about your publicity.
Yeah.
And not having as much as you would like.
Yes.
Next week, we'll teach you how to siphon gas.
Yeah, I think there's one other news story this week I think is worth talking about. I don't know if either of you were aware of the brief spell of fake games showing up on Steam this week.
I had heard about this, yeah.
Yeah, so... hundreds of fake games started showing up on Steam toward the end of last week, and this sort of first got noticed because a couple of fake Steam store pages for Helldivers 2 popped up on Steam. They both had Arrowhead as the developer and PlayStation as the publisher. They looked legitimate. They were basically perfect recreations of those games' Steam pages, but at steep discounts. They had positive reviews, not a huge number of them, but they had, like, mostly positive as the review thing. And if you purchased them, you received a game that was not Helldivers 2.
Did this one work, at least?
I mean, it worked in as much as whatever game it was did boot up.
Nice. I gotta be careful. You know what? I've not read a single comment in response to my Helldivers 2 review. I've heard about them. Through the grapevine, I've heard about them. But yeah, I've just decided, you know what? I'm not going to keep poking that hornet's nest. Like when Zilla added a certain visual joke in the Gymquisition, I was like, you know what? Not this week.
So this story is like weirdly a big thing. Steam acted upon this as people started noticing it, reporting it to developers, and the games did get taken down. But it was clearly a very thought-through-in-advance situation. Seemingly one developer had a bunch of games listed online, a bunch of, like, crappy shuffleware, like, nothing software. What he did with it, and these were all projects uploaded, I believe, October of last year. He made the price incredibly cheap in one region, I believe it was Russia, to purchase a bunch of copies of his own games via fake accounts to leave ratings to get it to the point where these games had a mostly positive rating. Then, over the course of a few months, changed the names and studios of those games a couple of times, sort of laundered them. And during this process, he jacked the price of these games up to, like, thousands of dollars so no one would purchase them, lowering those mostly positive reviews.
Wow.
Clearly testing to see whether there was any safeguards to determine what you could or could not change the name of your game to, the studio to, the publisher to. Seemingly, no safeguard to prevent you just saying that you are someone else in Steam's backend. To then change the games to the names of popular games, put the prices down so it looked like the games were massively discounted, and get them on sale. And clearly, like, anyone who booted these games up would very quickly see they were not the games they were supposed to be. That would be obvious. and that would likely be within Steam's refund window. But I've seen some people making some interesting points about this, which is those games have been taken off Steam, but if you have a code for them, like a Steam code for them, they still show up under the old fake name.
Mm.
So if you redeem a Steam code for this, it'll look like Helldivers 2. The theory I've seen doing the rounds is that the end game of this is to sell fake Helldivers 2 game keys to places like G2A that will redeem in Steam as Helldivers 2, and G2A's not going to do fucking shit if you redeem Helldivers 2 and tell them it wasn't Helldivers 2. That's what you get for buying on a reseller market. It seems like that was the scam.
Wow.
Was to be able to be fucking selling fake game keys to places like G2A, because by the time someone gets around to buying them off G2A, redeeming them, Steam's not going to give a shit that it's not that you bought a game off G2A and it wasn't what it was supposed to be. G2A is not great at refunding people. That's probably where the attempted laundering is. Valve has not been vocal about this, but I would assume they've put safeguards in place as a response to this to stop this happening. But yeah, it's a fucking mess of a situation that briefly happened with this developer changed like hundreds of games to names of other real games, and seemingly nothing stopped
him. It's a very complex grift. There's a part of me that is very impressed.
It's way more like thought through and like gradually eased into and long-term picture than I would expect this grift to be. They didn't just jump for the end goal. They tested things for a while.
Yeah, they made sure that this was going to fly on some level before they attempted it.
I will say, it's honestly amazing that no one's tried this before and that this hasn't been closed off before.
Yeah!
It's amazing that it took this long for someone to pretend their game was published by PlayStation.
That is a bit strange.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a weird little fascinating rabbit hole that is worth digging into, because it's a weird one for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it for this week. I think that's it.
That's it. It. Well. What do we think of that? And what are people who think, I want more of Laura's content actually, please? What can they do about that?
Oh, well, they can check out Laura K. Buzz pretty much everywhere. There is one place in particular I want to point people to this week. It's finally out there. The Tsujimon rap featuring Jonathan Holmes. 3 minutes of Jonathan Holmes rapping the names of every single Tsujimon from Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth, to the tune of the 1990s Poké Rap. It's a beautiful thing. I'm glad to have helped bring it into the world. I think this will be the thing that makes Jonathan famous, finally. I think this will be the one that gets him there.
Wow, just rub that in. Rub that in.
I know.
Oh god, I'd love to rub it in.
My favorite thing this has spawned is Jonathan put up a bounty for if someone could do the entire Tsuji rap in one take, no mistakes, no pauses, no edits. Someone did an 8-hour Twitch stream, 500 attempts to successfully perform the Tsujimon rap. So yeah, go check out Laura K. Buzz on YouTube. Go check out the Tsujimon rap. I love this stupid thing I spent like a week working on. What about you, Conrad? Where are you on the internet?
Oh, you can find me at Conrad Zimmerman on Instagram and Blue Sky. You can hang out with me on Twitch at twitch.tv/thatconradzimmerman. You could buy anti-capitalist propaganda and Jimquisition merchandise at mercenarycreative.com. And everything I do online gets supported through Patreon at patreon.com/fistshark. And you know who else has a Patreon? Why, it's Stephanie Sterling.
That's true. Patreon.com/Jimquisition. I realize that I have not been up to very much outside of the basic duties at the moment. There's just a lot going on, a lot of like personal stuff and stuff like that. I am looking at coming out of a lot of it now and hopefully can start picking stuff back up. But I just have had to take quite a bit of personal time. But hopefully back with like wrestling news and writing news and stuff soon. Got some game reviews coming out on thejimquisition.com. Should have a Pacific Drive one up before this podcast goes up. And we'll have one coming up for, I'm sure, Outlast Trials and Final Fantasy. But other than that, thank you all so much for listening and supporting. And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.